Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us to discuss the week on world markets, as they do every week, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Teal Group Consultancy. And more importantly, every single person on our team is on the road at the moment and not from where they normally join us. Guys, thanks very much for making some time for us, as always.
Great to be here, Vago. Thank you.
Yeah, it's really good to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Greetings from the lake, Vago. Great to be on the show.
I know. It's terrific because you're on a boat, Ron's by a lake, and Sash has been kind enough to pull over on the side of the road and talk to us. So we appreciate everybody making time for us. Before we get started...
No, but Vago, I'm by a river. It has to be water-themed. You've got to remember that.
Yes. Okay. Thanks very much. You're in your car by a river, so at least you have a decent view. So you've got that going for you. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. The coronavirus has been surging in the United States as well as in Europe, making, unfortunately, a comeback in certain pockets. Markets reeled after America's second quarter economic performance was the worst in its history. Airbus and Boeing were among the companies that reported earnings, with the American company saying and announcing the very, very sad news that production of the 747 jumbo jet that first went into production in 1970 with 1,500 planes built will be ended. Ron, start us off. We had a sharp drop in the U.S. economy. That was reflected, obviously, in the market that has been fueled, frankly, by roaring technology stocks, the CEOs of which ended up before the U.S. Congress last week. Millions have lost on enhanced unemployment benefits at a time when evictions are running high and as lawmakers are working on the fourth stimulus package that the market is eyeing very closely as well. What's the impact of all of this on our aerospace and defense corner of the universe?
Yeah, when you look in our corner of the world, and is there, we saw this come through loud and clear just over the last couple of weeks of earnings. Commercial aerospace is really taking it on the chin. You know, it's been hard. It's an obvious statement, but you know, the quarter that was supposed to be impacted most by COVID looks like it's going to stretch out and be the COVID half of the year. So instead of just the COVID quarter, it's the COVID half. On the defense side, though, however, the impacts so far have been pretty minimal, honestly, right? I mean, there's been some work disruptions and so on and so forth, but the defense companies broadly have been able to weather the storm quite well, and they've all been active participants, passing cash flow down to their suppliers to help buoy the folks in the supply chain that are more dependent on commercial aero and other industrial spaces outside of defense that have been impacted. So broadly, that's what you've seen. We've seen, commercial aerospace, interestingly, if you look back into the March lows, has been tracking back towards those levels. I mean, some of the smaller suppliers have really, really taken it on the chin. Even if you look at some of the bigger companies, Boeing shares last week, retraced almost half of what they gained after their March lows. And ultimately, given what's going on in commercial aerospace, I don't think that should be much of a surprise. On the defense front, the defense stocks we talked about in previous shows kind of have contracted over election worries and so on and so forth in terms of valuation. But we've seen a little bit more of a robust trading environment for defense because they've been powering through this current environment like you'd expect, given that they're in some ways immune to it. So I'd say that's where we are, Vago.
Richard, let me go to you and ask you to sort of give us a sense on where we are on commercial air travel. Obviously, IATA, the International Air Transport Association, has put out its new figures. We heard United say that it wants to boost leisure routes in September. Obviously, the coronavirus has the last vote. And we heard from Air Canada CEO Calin Rovinescu, who's blasting the Trudeau government for its travel restrictions and saying that unless his company gets a bailout, then he might cancel orders of Canadian-made airplanes, which is a pretty tough statement coming from the man who actually turned Air Canada around and turned it into the success that it is now. Give us a sense on where we are on the broader sort of commercial market drivers. And then, Sash, if you could comment on kind of the broader picture, would be great as well. Start us off, Richard.
IATA reduced its forecast for the year to a negative 63%, which of course sounds terrible, but it implies some kind of recovery in the fourth quarter, which is frankly unlikely to happen. More intriguingly, or perhaps concerningly, or mysteriously, they put off their recovery to the 2019 traffic peak till 2024. And I'm not really sure what the motivation for that was. I understand the net negative 63%. But it would seem like there's more progress than expected on a vaccine. As a matter of fact, Dr. Fauci even implied that you could have sort of a first quarter deus ex machina. And, you know, conceivably, there's no reason to change a traffic recovery from in 2023 and maybe even move it slightly forward towards earlier in that year. So they moved it to 2024. I'm not sure if that was more than just a structural numerical reason to do it rather than a solid likely scenarios given the vaccine move. But either way, the numbers are just getting worse and worse.
And what about the United route resumption? I mean, is that something that you think is realistic? And then Kalen's statement about not taking delivery of airplanes pending the bailout.
You know, people are putting a brave face on bookings and the likelihood of some kind of comeback, but it's not really clear what the market's going to support. And of course, when you bring back routes, you bring back capacity, and the RPKs aren't there, then of course you really can get in serious trouble from an airline profitability standpoint. Air Canada has a point, of course, because support for Air Canada has been lagging relative to other countries. In general, though, government support for airlines worldwide looks set to run out in just a few weeks, and tough decisions have to be made, just like in the broader economy, whether or not there's going to be an additional package. So far, worldwide, about $130 billion has been provided. It looks like there's going to need to be more if the industry is going to stay intact until that recovery happens.
Sash, why don't you give us your sense? Because if I look at the IATA numbers, they're actually closer to your projection of 2025 rather than 2023, which has been the expectation of a lot of people. Walk us through how you see both the broader market dynamic, looking at it from a European perspective, and then the specifics on where we are on what IATA is saying and what you're hearing out of airlines. And this is sort of to set the predicate before we get into the next part of our conversation, which is Boeing and Airbus and how grossly unrealistic their sales forecasts are.
Okay. I think that there are, there's actually two very separate elements of, components to IATA's forecast. And I think that we sometimes forget that. There is the issue of propensity to travel. Do people want to travel? Are they able to travel? And that's where the vaccines come in. It's quite interesting, just from this side of the Atlantic, and, you know, there's a hell of a lot of work being done on vaccines in the UK as much as anything else, and the UK government is buying millions of doses of vaccines pretty much every week at the moment, or at least pre-buying them. But there, Q1 21 would be a really good result in terms of availability of vaccines, and then it'll probably take most of 2021 before most of the population gets those vaccines. So that's going to that's going to be a pretty long recovery process just before people are able to travel. But then, and I think this is the thing we tend to forget, because we all get focused on, frankly, when are we personally going to get a vaccine? But then there's the issue that we are going to be in the worst recession, not just any of us have ever experienced, but, any of our parents have ever experienced. And corporate travel budgets, which we've talked about week in, week out, are going to be pared to the bone. So even if we all leap on a leisure flight again, which is, it's a possibility, but not till next summer. Corporate travel, which tends to be the much higher yielding travel, simply isn't going to bounce back anything like as quickly. And I think that's why, the IELTS number keeps slipping. 2024 doesn't seem to me to be at all unrealistic, because economies are going to take a long time. And, you had very bad numbers, economic numbers in the US. The numbers in Europe are dreadful. Really awful. Recovery from that feels to be very, very slow. And that, I think, is you know, the backdrop to all this. Just as far as airline bailouts are concerned, Air Canada isn't alone. I think what's been very interesting in Europe has been there have been very different ways, particularly in the UK, very different ways of bailing airlines out. The UK government actually has, you know, set up a rule which said we will support industry, but you know, the broader industry, but actually they've got to exhaust all other possible sources of funding first. So you remember Virgin went and tapped their shareholders, including Delta, for a huge amount of money, and British Airways, IAG Group, this week announced it's going to raise $2.7 billion in an equity issuance. Once they've done that, I think then they can go to the UK government and indeed the Spanish government and say, okay, your turn now. But you know, the refinancing of airlines is it's a very uneven process. And some countries, I think, are probably playing rather harder ball in terms of whose responsibility it is than others.
Ron, I know you want to pitch in on with a thought as well.
Yeah, just following up on Sasha's comments. I think he's, you know, right on. I think one of the worry points for IATA was actually business confidence, that they're seeing a pretty severe decoupling between business confidence and air travel. There was, you know, a correlation there that, given the pandemic environment, has fallen apart. And I think that's what added caution to their forecast. And then the one thing I might add, this is what's, you know, for everybody the same frustration, trying to do these forecasts in this environment where there's really very little history, and you're kind of trying to base things on previous down cycles that were very different. The, you know, the forecasting environment is just really horribly difficult. So if you're going to hedge a little bit, say things are going to be extended, that's probably a reasonable bet for all of the aforementioned reasons.
Look, I mean, I think a big part of the challenge, despite Dr. Fauci being sort of optimistic that we may have a vaccine by the end of the year, there are a whole lot of people putting a lot of faith and a lot of money, right? Whether it's Indian billionaires buying up vaccines that haven't even been proven yet. Obviously, the Russians stole so much from everybody that they were able to accelerate their vaccine program. I think that much is obviously clear with Russia sort of strutting around and saying that they've cured it. But the question with any vaccine is, A, is it as effective as it needs to be? Does it have any kind of side effects at the end of the day? And then it's the sheer challenge of getting the vaccines out there and getting everybody inoculated, especially at a time when anti-vaxxers have a lot of momentum. There are going to be people in France and England and anywhere else in the world that are not going to want to take those vaccines, right? I mean, people think that 5G is giving them the coronavirus, right? I mean, so if you're dealing with that kind of a population, This is certainly not going to be something very easy. Any closing thoughts on this before we shift to another fantasy land that is apparently where Airbus and Boeing are living?
Perhaps if I could just add just one last point. I think it's going to be, there's been a lot of reluctance to enforce, for example, wearing face masks on airplanes. I do wonder, though, once a vaccine is available, whether you're going to have to show, as is starting to be the case, either a certificate of having had a coronavirus test before you're allowed to fly or allowed to enter a country, or that you have been inoculated. And that may be what is required to address the problem that you've, I think, very rightly highlighted of the anti-vaxxers, because otherwise there won't be the herd immunity. Coronavirus will keep on breaking out, and that's going to have the effect in terms of on-off lockdowns, and then the effect in terms of economic damage.
I mean, look, I think even the virus test certificate indicates something that is passed. So you have no idea who you came into contact since you had the test, unless you literally had the test before you entered the airport. And even when you were in the airport, you may have come into contact. Anyway, I mean, it's all sort of intellectually problematic. Let's go. Ron, start us off. Boeing reported, Airbus reported, Northrop reported, a number of other companies as well. We'll get to those contractors first, but give us a sense on what we heard from Boeing. I mean, obviously the 747 news was sad for those of us who loved that iconic airplane. They followed suit, obviously, following sort of Airbus's and rather the market's lead on the A380 going out of production as well some months earlier. Walk us through what Boeing told us, what Airbus told us, and then we can go around the horn to Sash and then to Richard about what these numbers mean. Start us off.
Yeah, sure. So I'll kick us off with the U.S. companies, and you can hand it over to Sash for Airbus and the stuff he focuses on. You know, the Boeing numbers were essentially when they came out and said, hey, you know what, we're going to lower 787 production rates and we're going to do it almost immediately. That shouldn't have surprised anybody, but they said that. So 787 numbers are coming down. They also said on the 787 program, they're studying going to one production line, right? So right now, for those who don't know, it's produced in South Carolina and in Everett, Washington. In Boeing parlance, typically studying means they're going to go to one line. They're just going to be one or the other. They're going to figure out which one they're going to shut down. 737, Spirit AeroSystems let the cat out of the bag last week with some commentary around some banking activity they were doing, that the production of 737s is going to go to a trickle. Boeing's going to try to deliver most everything they can out of their inventory first and kind of get that out before they really start doing anything off the line. So they kind of doubled down on the rate at which the 737 line is going to go. And then I might add on their defense business, their defense numbers actually weren't very good. I mean, when you look at the large defense primes, Northrop Grumman, who did report, I think they were the all-star champion in terms of, they had 1.7 times book-to-bill. Lockheed Martin was around 1.3. Raytheon Technologies defense business was 1.1, 1.2, I forget the exact number, but Boeing kind of came in just around one. So they were kind of lagging their peers in a quarter that broadly for defense was very, very strong in terms of bookings because of a lot of the activity that DoD is doing to push contracts into the channel so stuff can get pushed into the suppliers. So the Boeing quarter wasn't great and felt a lot like Boeing quarters pre-pandemic, if you will, kind of passe. A lot of focus on cost and cash flow, but they didn't really address the future and what's going next and a focus on engineering and engineering excellence and so on and so forth. That's something we took issue with. So why don't I leave it there and hand it off to Sash for his take on Airbus and the Europeans.
Sash, give us your take on the world's largest commercial aircraft company.
It was an interesting quarter because it was it was clearly a bad quarter. We knew it was going to be that. They had a 4.4 billion euro cash outflow. They've ended the quarter with 145 aircraft built but not yet delivered. And I think there's a degree of concern that not all those aircraft are going to get delivered by the end of the year. It's not just a logistics problem, but it may be that some of those aircraft are now available for delivery to an airline that can no longer take or no longer wants to take delivery of them. And, AirAsia, I'm looking at you here. We had a very, very bad quarter. The issue, I think, is that their ambition to, return to some sort of free cash flow by the end of the year, and we take that to mean in the fourth quarter, that's very much based on a best case scenario. If there is any further lockdowns or anything else, then I think we're going to see the production issues extend well into 2021. It was very interesting. They cut the A350 again, only by one aircraft, but A350 was 10 to 11 at the start of the aircraft a month at the start of the year. Then they cut it to six. Then they said, well, really it's 5 to 6. Now they've cut it to 5, going down anybody. Just nobody needs wide bodies at the moment. Don't really need narrow bodies either. But our feeling is that we're going to see these, they're not exactly stealth cuts because they've got to announce them, but we're going to see these nibbling away at production rates going on through pretty much every single successive quarter as they realize that, first one program and then another simply are not sustainable at the current production rates. And I mean, we did a bit of calculation looking at the stated ambitions of Boeing and Airbus. And we came out with production rates that are equivalent to a new industry record in 2021. I mean, Airbus has got production rates of 5 A350s, 2 A330s, 4 A220s, 40 A320s per month. So that's, 560, 580 aircraft a year. And, if you go through the Boeing numbers, including the aircraft they're going to bring back into the maxes they want to bring back into service, you get to 660, 670. Overall, we're talking about at least as many aircraft re-entering the market as in 2018. Our view is that's just not realistic. but there's this sort of game of production chicken going on. Nobody wants to announce another really big set cut first because they're worried they'll lose face, but more importantly, they're worried that they'll cede some market share to the other guy. And they're still, certainly, you know, Airbus is still very much in a market share. There's going to be a bounce back. There's going to be a snap back in demand is the term they're using at the moment. And they want to be ready for that. I think it's quite concerning in terms of overall industry dynamics.
I want to get to the issue of whether or not the 787 line in Everett or in South Carolina is going to close. But Richard, let's go to you and get your sense on all of this and you know all of the delusional aspects of it for which we both appreciate and love both of these companies.
Yeah, I mean, Sash puts it well, sort of like a Satan's game of market share where they're no longer trying to grow. They're just delusionally trying to protect. And, you know, I think in all of our minds, okay, going to 6 787s per month, okay, that's a level of rationality long overdue. And I found myself thinking, well, that's certainly welcome news that they've accepted reality. Then I'm like, okay, so who exactly are the 72 customers who will be taking delivery of 7/8s next year? And, oh boy, that's hard. So I think there's still more days of reckoning to come. Moving forward, the 787 production line decision is going to be a tough one. As Ron says, yeah, in Boeing parlance, that means they're going to want, not they're studying the issue. And it's the Dash 10 is only built in South Carolina, and they're not likely to pay to move that capability to Everett. On the other hand, you know, one day there's going to be a refresh, might be 5 years, might be 10 years. And the idea of co-locating design, engineering, and manufacturing is going to be pretty appealing. And that's, of course, only done in Everett. So it's not really clear what the outcome would be. Probably they'll just keep South Carolina going. But that raises the question of, wow, Everett, a whole lot of capacity, no longer an active 7-4 line, 777X delayed, 7-6 at 2 per month or something like that, 777 legacy going down, and 7-8 possibly going away altogether. That will be the biggest aerospace facility that simply isn't doing very much in a year or two. And that's really daunting.
I think that it's fascinating to me that one of the reasons they went, that Jim McNerney went to South Carolina was to go to a non-union state in order to break the back of the union. And at the end of the day, what Boeing does is maybe just impose cost on itself as a consequence, in part because of some of the challenges, obviously, of getting that line started as well. Let's talk about that briefly though, Ron. What are the implications of that kind of a decision and the loss of that kind of extraordinary capability that's going to have ripple effects, not just on Washington State, not just on the Pacific Northwest, but also U.S. aerospace manufacturing? I mean, Everett has been one of the most incredible concentrations of capability on the planet. Or at least that.
Yeah, I think it's too soon to say that it's going to be South Carolina. You know, it's a pretty open debate right now which way it's going to go. And I'm certain the state of South Carolina is going to have a say in this, and so will the state of Washington. Also, don't forget, you know, the Air Force tanker comes out of Everett, and it would have if the 787 stopped up there, it would have all kinds of implications for the cost structure of the tanker. And so there's some broader considerations that happen. So to me, at this point, it's unclear which side wins. But you're exactly right. I mean, you know, the focal point of wide body production in North America has been Everett, Washington, right? So if that were to shut down, I mean, it would have, I don't want to, you know, be too dramatic, but it, you know, pretty consequential implication on the aerospace supply chain, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, right? You know, for sure, among others, right? But it's a tricky decision for them. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, right? I mean, it's not as simple as just shutting down because there's other programs. So at this point, I'm not going to venture a guess on which side, but I've heard, you know, convincing arguments that, you know, South Carolina is where it should be, or Everett's where it should be. But this is for sure. If you're building these things at 6 per month, and we actually are going to go down to 5 per month, having two lines makes no sense. So, you know, going right down to one line, wherever it is for sure the right decision.
Sash, your sense on all of this as somebody who always brings a strategic lens to these kinds of issues?
Multiple production lines work for, or certainly have worked for, Airbus in narrowbody. And, you know, Airbus, I think, has made an absolute virtue out of duplicating the final assembly lines of the A320, not necessarily in Europe. I mean, there's a lot of politics in the final assembly lines in France and Germany, but, you know, the multiple assembly lines at Tianjin and Mobile, I think, have been absolutely brilliant in terms of market access. But wide body, I agree, it's really hard to see how you can justify two lines for any wide body program. And we've got to remember that the decision, or among the things that drove the decision to open South Carolina, was an expectation that the 787 would be being delivered at 14 a month, not five, you know, so nearly three times the current rate. Given that that doesn't look to be a realistic, this, you know, certainly this first half of this decade, and probably the second half either, of course they've got to revisit the two lines.
Let's just cover the other key earnings. Ron, you mentioned Northrop Sash. Why don't you give us a tour of some of the European earnings over the week that we missed since last week? Safran, I think, was one of those who reported as well. Kind of give us a roundup on where we stand on everybody.
Yeah, I mean, in Europe, pure defense companies that did what it says on the tin actually performed very well in stock market terms. BAE had a very, very good day on the day of their results. We're clearly going to come back to the issue of AMPV in a minute, I think. But you know, BAE delivered on their numbers. They reinstated their dividend. And there was remarkably little other effect from civil aerospace and sort of general perturbations. Ultra Electronics, which is the nearest thing to a pure defense company anywhere in our space, had an absolutely fantastic day. Not because the results were particularly brilliant, but because there was just no signs of any effect of lockdowns and so forth. Safran actually performed, you know, was a very, very good set of results. And really what marked Safran out for us is that they were more proactive in terms of cost reduction early on than any other company we look at. What's interesting, though, is that Safran has cut costs most deeply outside France. They have a huge aerospace wiring business in Mexico. They've got the seating and interiors business, the old Cindy, in the US. And they really took an axe to their non-French businesses. Cutting costs in France is much, much harder. And what we wonder is whether, unless things stabilize the way that clearly everybody hopes, whether Safran's got the ability to do that again or not. But certainly, you know, they've been the standout performer in terms of costs so far, both in terms of timing and in terms of the depth of the costs. You know, taking out 20-25% of their costs by the end of the current year, that's a phenomenally impressive performance. You know, by contrast, Airbus, where more of the costs are inside Europe, they are reducing costs by about 15%, but really, They won't get there until the middle of the year, middle of next year, which means they won't get the full benefit until the end of the year.
Ron, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I'd say broadly on the U.S. side, the big trends that we saw were commercial aftermarket numbers for most suppliers down anywhere from, call it 50-60%. Commercial OE numbers down pretty similar, honestly, you know, in a range, call it kind of 45-60%. And that was pretty much across the board, right? There was some little variances among companies, but that was sort of the theme. And the commercial businesses across the board burned up a lot of cash. You pick the company, they burned up cash. On the defense side, however, most of the companies had pretty good growth, right? L3 Harris was one of the names that reported this past week, and their defense business had organic growth of about 8%. And most of the other defense primes, you go from Lockheed to Northrop Pickett, General Dynamics defense business, they all had reasonable organic growth. And one point I might add that I think surprised some folks, when you look at how Gulfstream did, you know, the business jet market for purchases of new business jets kind of slowed down. But Gulfstream, in fact, actually delivered one more business jet this quarter than they did last year this quarter. And they seem to be faring, all things considered, actually reasonably well in the current environment. But I would say those are the broad trends.
when you look at your flight radar, it's interesting to me how many private aircraft are still flying around, whereas how relatively few commercial airplanes are flying around. And I think that suggests, you know, the strength of the market. And Sash, it was interesting you mentioned Ultra. I think Ultra is one of the most interesting companies on the planet. And so it's always always good and interesting to hear, you know, a company that innovative is still doing well despite everything that happened. Ron and Sash, let me quickly go to you before we end this for the week. Let's talk a little bit about delays on defense programs. Obviously, we know the F-35 Lightning II program with Lockheed Martin as the prime contractor has experienced delays because of coronavirus, in part because of its international supply lines and how badly Italy was impacted. That's a critical partner on the program. Now, Bloomberg Pentagon reporter Tony Capasio is reporting a five-month delay on the AMPV program, which is the armored vehicle that BAE Systems is developing under a $15 billion contract for some 3,000 vehicles for the U.S. Army. That's been delayed in part because of coronavirus, in part because of welding and other issues. We heard from Sash that BAE Systems had a great earnings season. Any sort of wider implications that we're seeing? I mean, what's more to add on this aside from the fact that obviously companies are waiting for Congress to reimburse them?
I would add one point, Vago, actually, and I think this made them a standout. When you look at all the companies that reported this quarter, defense or otherwise, you know, everybody was saying, you know, we had this sort of impact, we had that sort of impact, it was this dollar value. One company that didn't was Northrop Grumman. You know, Northrop Grumman didn't sign the letter to the DOD or whoever it was about getting refunded for their COVID costs or whatever it was. And when they were asked on that, you know, Northrop said, hey, you know what, we're managing it okay. And you know what, we don't think this is something that we have to burden taxpayers with. So they were markedly different than the other contractors. So we'll see. I mean, you know, different companies have been handling it differently for sure. You know, when you look at what Lockheed told the street, Lockheed was a little more cautious on F-35 because not just international, but it's in Fort Worth, Texas, and Texas is having its issues right now with right. the virus and even on their missile business, which a big piece of that's in Florida. Florida, as we all know, is having their issues. So they took a little caution on, you know, the outlook there and you know, for good reason, right? But yeah, I think I really do have to shout out Northrop here for, you know, standing up and saying, hey, you know what, we got this. This is kind of, we're managing it and we don't think we got to throw this bill back on taxpayers. So then they were, you know, unique in that.
Sash, yeah. Anything to add before we part for the week?
Yeah, I mean, just on BAE and the AMPV, you know, a delay due to coronavirus, you know, particularly in the startup phase, shouldn't be much of a surprise. I'm a little bit distressed that they're having welding problems again. This was one of the problems that afflicted the M109A7, the former Paladin self-propelled howitzer program. Paladin was clearly not a good program in terms of the startup phase there, and it's just very niggling that they should be having, you know, not identical, but certainly similar problems. In particular, since, you know, AMPV is a brand new hull, and they should be capable of doing the cutting, doing the laser welding of it. It's not as if they're having to retrofit or having to refit an existing hull and then, reinstall it and reassemble it again. So, you know, it's a bit of a warning here that I think BA may have quite a lot on their plate. They've clearly got the M109 AMPV and also the Marines ACV program. Perhaps they're just playing slightly whack-a-mole in terms of program management there.
Certainly something that everybody ought to be paying attention to. We've got about a minute left. 3, 2, 1. We've got about a minute left. Richard, any 737 MAX news that we need to be talking about?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that now that Boeing has prioritized getting the inventory out the door, the 450 jets that have already been delivered, you know, we'd been assuming a little more than 2, possibly 3 years to deliver them. Now it's 1, but they haven't moved deliveries, which means they're not actually going to be building very much next year. So it raises big questions about the health of the supply chain. And maybe Boeing is again shooting itself in the foot because they'll just have to intervene with a bit of assistance to companies that will be badly afflicted by far lower than expected manufacturing numbers for new MAXes.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. By the way, in cool aerospace news, as we were recording this, SpaceX's Crew Dragon spacecraft made the first successful splashdown in 45 years of an American spacecraft in the Gulf of Mexico off of Pensacola. And I want to note for our audience that monitoring that landing was NASA's, one of NASA's, or at least some of NASA's WB-57F aircraft, obviously the descendant of the one of the greatest jet-powered aircraft, and indeed one of the greatest airplanes ever, the English Electric Canberra, that I should point out, Sash has some stick time on, which I think is pretty extraordinary. Isn't it cool? I mean, it is one of the coolest airplanes around, and you know, was iconic and something I loved both in its English Electric Canberra trim as well as its Martin B-57. And Sash, it really did handle amazingly, didn't it?
It was. I mean, even the older RAF aircraft, which were, you know, were not terribly aggressively powered, and where the wing was just normal Canberra, were unbelievably agile at altitude. And the pilots were very, very happy to do aerobatics in those at, you know, many, many, many tens of feet that you wouldn't expect from a bomber. I would love to see or hear, you know, what the performance of the WB-57 is, because, you know, that really took all of the things that was great about the original Canberra and then put, you know, more powerful engines and an even bigger wing. What a great combination. And, you know, it's a, there's a lovely sort of, you know, symmetry of that and the newest US spacecraft in the business.
Yeah, isn't it amazing that the oldest jet is still connected to something that is you know, one of the oldest jets certainly, and is still connected to it, and is still an extraordinarily great high altitude platform of altitude of more than 70,000 feet. And Sierra Nevada brought back a third one during the height of Afghanistan, where everybody was wondering what on earth WB-57s were doing. NASA WB-57s were. Former NASA WB-57s were doing over a war zone.
I mean, Varga, I'm reminded with my deep love, I'll share deep love of the Canberra, probably the best apocryphal story about that aircraft, which is allegedly of a Canberra pilot calling up air traffic control somewhere in America and saying, and requesting flight level 70, which as our listeners will realize is 70,000 feet. And at that level, anybody needs to be wearing a full pressure suit. And so forth. And air traffic control apocryphally replied, "Buddy, if you can get there, you can have it." At which the Canberra pilot replied with, you know, typical coolness, "Roger, descending to flight level 70.
I think the U2 guys would say that that's their joke, but I'm willing to give it to...
absolutely. But they're the only two aircraft in the world that can play that one. It's wonderful.
Absolutely, especially now that the SR is gone. Guys, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Vargo.
Yeah, thanks, Vargo.
Great to be here, Vargo. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.